Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to Solving the Puzzle with Dr. Datis Karazian, informing you about evidence-based strategies for autoimmune disease, brain health issues, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, gut health problems, and many other chronic health conditions. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at drknews.com.
Hi, everyone. Today we're going to go over one of the most common but also important issues of intestinal permeability called endotoxemia or leaky gut. So, one of the things that a lot of people have learned about over the past few years and has really developed a lot of credibility is this whole model of intestinal permeability or leaky gut. Leaky gut was a concept that was first identified in the fields of dental medicine and the link between periodontal infections and its impact on the rest of the system, and then those patterns of barrier breakdown then led to bacterial release into the system called endotoxemia. And as time has gone on, people in natural medicine have always made the connection between bad diets, poor gut health, gut permeability, and it was in recent years where there's been an explosion of research on intestinal permeability or leaky gut. And within that explosion of research, lots of very exciting things have come out in our understanding about how the gut impacts chronic disease and chronic inflammation. And one of the things that we know is that a lot of people have leaky gut. A lot of people have intestinal permeability. And there's a lot of reasons for mechanisms that cause intestinal permeability. It could be a bad diet, it could be antibiotic use, it could be hormone imbalances, but it's usually a cluster of many different things. And what I want to do today is really focus on having you understand a few important concepts. What is this phenomena that they call endotoxemia? How does that relate to leaky gut? Why do some people have leaky gut and have lots of symptoms and have chronic disease from it? And why do some people not have any symptoms or very little symptoms when they have leaky gut? And then how do you identify it? What kind of lab tests do you do? What kind of applications there are for it and so forth? So let's first talk about leaky gut, and then we'll move into all the steps. And by the way, I just want to let you guys know that we have a brand new online program put together for 2021, first part of 2021, January. We'll be launching our new program called Gut Health, Solving the Puzzle. And I put together a four-week program into teaching you how to figure out what's going on with your gut and understand how to follow clinical strategies that are specific to your own findings. So it's going to include videos and workbooks and questionnaires and recipe guides and all this stuff to really walk you through the process of how to figure out what's going on with your gut and how to manage it just as if you were a patient in my office. So we'll be doing that early 2021. If you go to Dr. K News, you can sign up to get information when the course is released, and we'll obviously offer people who've signed up early promotional items if they want to take the course. Now, let's get back into leaky gut. So when you look at laboratory testing and in a clinical setting, when you measure markers for leaky gut, and the markers are, this is called zonulin, occludin antibodies, for example, you can see that a lot of people actually have intestinal permeability. Like a lot of people have leaky gut. And part of the reason is because there's so many things that cause leaky gut. So if you have a chronic inflammatory diet, if you're under lots of stress, even if you're sedentary, if you don't exercise, if you're sensitive to things like gluten and dairy, you continue to eat them. If you have any kind of autoimmune disease, if you have uncontrolled diabetes, if your blood sugar levels are really high, if your antioxidant reserves become compromised, and then combination of those things and many other things all really lead to the potential for you to have leaky gut, which means the intestinal tight junctions start to open up. And when the intestinal tight junctions open up, food proteins can cross. And one of the first things people notice is that when they start to get leaky gut, they start to develop reactions to foods that they may have not had before. Now, there's a couple things that you want to understand about that. So some people have leaky gut, but they don't have reactions to food. And part of the reason why is because they digest their food really well. So when you look at why some people develop food sensitivities with leaky gut and why some people don't, part of the reason is because of how well a person's digestion is. So let me share with you some concepts here. And these are things we'll be going over in our gut health puzzle course too, because I think what happens, there's a lot of information out there, but people don't understand the concepts. So when you don't understand concepts, everything becomes confusing to you. So let me explain a very important concept. If you have two people and they both have intestinal permeability, they both have leaky gut and their gut barriers have opened up, okay? If one person is inefficient in their digestion of food proteins, so maybe they're not making enough hydrochloric acid, they're not making enough pancreatic enzymes, for example, and they can't really break down the proteins that they're consuming and the starches, or even maybe they're not producing enough bile, or they're not breaking down their fats properly. But if they're not digesting their foods and they both have leaky gut, and then another person is properly breaking down their foods, there's a completely different response that happens to them. So even though they both have leaky gut, the person who is able to digest their food proteins, by the time their food gets digested and gets into the small intestine for absorption, those food proteins are all broken down into small amino acids, and there's going to be no immune reaction against them. Now, if you take the other person that has leaky gut, just like the first one, but the other person can't break down their proteins, they're not digesting their food very well, so they have undigested or uncompletely broken down proteins in their system, those larger food particles that normally cannot cross a tight, healthy gut, but now since the gut's open, undigested food particles can now, much that are much larger in molecular weight, can now cross, and that causes food sensitivity. So one of the important concepts to understand is you could have two people that have leaky gut, but if you have proper digestion of a protein into amino acids, then there's no immune reaction and no development of new foods. On the other hand, if you have leaky gut and you do have issues with breaking down protein or digesting foods, then it's very likely that you'll have undigested food particles that will cross, and those undigested food particles are not individual amino acids. They're clusters of amino acids stuck together called polypeptides, and those polypeptides are going to trigger the immune response, and then the immune system is going to make antibodies and react against those peptides. And then the next time you eat those foods that have those peptides in them, your body has made antibodies to a region of those proteins, and then you start to react against those food proteins, and now you have the development of food sensitivity. So the important concept that I was trying to share with you with that scenario is that leaky gut by itself doesn't necessarily lead to every single problem or different problems. Leaky gut has to be part of a picture that involves other steps along the way. So with development of food sensitivities, if you have leaky gut but you're properly breaking down and digesting your food proteins, it's unlikely you'll develop food sensitivities. However, if you have hypochlorhydria and you don't digest protein well, or you don't digest starch as well, every time you get bloated and distended, then you're going to have some problems if you have leaky gut, because now you have undigested food proteins that get through the gut, and now you start to develop food sensitivities. So that's a concept. That's not just more information. So that's one of the key concepts. So leaky gut with maldigestion and inability to produce digestive enzymes is totally different than leaky gut with proper digestion. Now, the same thing goes with when we talk about today's topic, which is called endotoxemia. So endotoxemia is a condition in which bacteria produce endotoxins, and then those endotoxins get into the bloodstream. And like I was saying earlier, endotoxemia and the mechanism of how endotoxemia of bacteria can cause chronic disease was first really identified in the dental field with periodontal infections and periodontal disease, gum disease. What they found out was that the bacteria that is involved with various types of periodontal diseases and diseases of the gums has led to chronic inflammation in the body and to even cardiovascular risk. This is why the American Dental Association really promotes good gum and dental hygiene to prevent risk factors like cardiovascular disease. There's an abundance of research that shows that. So in that scenario, what happens is the bacteria that's found in the gums from poor dental health can then get into circulation and then cause inflammation throughout the body. So that's endotoxemia. Well, the same thing can happen in the gut. And what happens is that bacteria that's in the gut, especially adverse bacteria, when a person has dysbiosis, they can have bacteria release endotoxins. So bacteria will always have its own output. So bacteria produces what are called postbiotics. And some postbiotics help the body, and some postbiotics harm the body. Postbiotics that actually harm the body are called endotoxins. Endo, being they're produced within the body, toxin. In this case, bacteria is producing these endotoxins within the body. Now, endotoxemia means these endotoxins not get into circulation. So when you look at a gut membrane, we all have bacteria there. And in certain states, we have a condition that's called dysbiosis. And dysbiosis means we have more bad bacteria than good bacteria. And we know that diet and lifestyle can actually change the ratios of what we call beneficial or pathogenic bacteria. So we know diets that are really high in sugar, diets that are really high in fats, processed foods, diets that are very low in fiber and low in antioxidants start to shift people into dysbiosis. So, you know, even just the basic standard American diet where people are eating fast food every day, eating very little vegetables, that will actually shift people into a pattern of dysbiosis. So when you have dysbiosis, now you have these larger populations of these adverse, unhealthy bacteria. And there's a whole bunch of different species of them. There's no point to get into all those names. But those adverse bacteria then produce their own compounds. And one of the compounds that they produce are lipopolysaccharides, which are sugar protein cup substances, and they're called endotoxins. Now, if a person has healthy intestinal tight junctions, it's not a problem for the most part. They may not have the best digestive function and the best digestive health. They may have some issues with the dysbiosis itself, but it's not going to cause significant inflammatory responses throughout the body. Now, everything changes if they have a leaky gut. If they have a leaky gut, then those endotoxins that are normally found just in the gut microenvironment can then get into circulation. And then when these dysbiotic bacteria produce these lipopolysaccharides, which are endotoxins, and they get into systemic circulation, that is now called systemic endotoxemia. And it's the worst scenario of leaky gut. So if you have two people, once again, a different scenario, both people have leaky gut. One person has leaky gut, but they don't have dysbiosis. Their diet's pretty healthy. They're eating good foods. They don't have this. They're eating lots of fiber. They're eating lots of plants. They're eating lots of superfoods like broccoli and acai and blueberries. And they have a very rich, colorful diet of lots of different healthy fruits and vegetables. And they have a leaky gut. Well, in those scenarios, they don't have dysbiosis. They have lots of healthy bacteria. So even though their tight junctions are opened up, they have leaky gut, they're not noticing a lot of symptoms from it. Now, you take another person that has, let's say, the same degree of leaky gut, the same degree of intestinal permeability, but in this scenario, their dysbiosis, because of their diet being poor, produces these lipopolysaccharides that then get into circulation, and now you get a whole host of problems. So this is the worst scenario of leaky gut. This is when you have intestinal permeability with endotoxemia. And when you have this endotoxin, and the reference to the name of the endotoxin is, they just use the general term lipopolysaccharide. There's different variations of lipopolysaccharides, but these gram-negative lipopolysaccharides that come from dysbiotic pathogenic bacteria, they have systemic effects throughout the entire body. So these lipopolysaccharides then get into the bloodstream, and they bind to something called toll-like receptors. And toll-like receptors are just these receptors that are found all throughout your body. And specifically, it's toll-like receptor 4. And they bind to toll-like receptor 4. And this could be in your gut, it could be in your lungs, it could be in your brain, it could be in your joints. I mean, it goes, all the different cells in your body have cell membranes, and they all have these toll-like receptors. And these lipopolysaccharides bind to the TLR4 branch. And when they bind to them, this then turns on a inflammatory response within the cell. And it specifically turns on a pathway called NF-kappa-B. And NF-kappa-B pathway is a very pro-inflammatory pathway. So what they find is that for people that have leaky gut, but specifically with people that have leaky gut and endotoxemia, their leaky gut causes massive inflammation throughout their body. And this will turn on brain inflammation. This will further perpetuate gut inflammation. This will turn on joint inflammation. This will turn on, basically, to add fuel to the fire wherever there's a fire, right? So if someone has injured knee, their knee is going to really flare up because those injured cells are not being turned on, and they already have some degree of inflammatory activity anyways. If they've had a brain injury and there's some inflammation in the brain that's remnant from the brain injury, those LPS is going to really turn on those injured cells. They're going to have much greater effects from that, for example. So this is the reason why some people that have leaky gut don't even know have any symptoms, and other people that have leaky gut completely fall apart. So it's not just the leaky gut. It has to do with leaky gut and other factors. So one of them is digestive enzymes for like filling food sensitivities, for the pathway of causing chronic inflammation, really turning on debilitating autoimmune disease. You're really worried about not just leaky gut, but you're worried about leaky gut in combination with dysbiosis, where you have this pathogenic bacteria now start to promote these lipopolysaccharides that get into circulation. Now, in a clinical setting, we can measure them. So like one of the most effective tests to use for this is a panel through Cyrex Labs, and it's called Cyrex Rate 2, and it measures if a person has leaky gut. So they measure proteins called occludin zonulin, and they measure actual gram-negative lipopolysaccharides. And if the lipopolysaccharide levels are high in blood, then that person not only has leaky gut, but they have leaky gut with endotoxemia. And as a clinician, when you see that, everything changes. Now you know that their leaky gut is going to cause significant and severe inflammation throughout their body, and they're at risk for many conditions. Now, this model of endotoxemia and leaky gut is well-studied, well-published in the immunology literature. I'm not sure if it's, you know, transferred into the way a general practitioner will practice in conventional healthcare. But in the field of immunology, the study of endotoxemia and the study of endotoxemia primarily has a large amount of research at this current state. So we know it's a well-established known mechanism. Now, let me explain what this endotoxemia does to people and how they have, what kind of symptoms they present with, okay? So once someone starts to develop these endotoxemia patterns, where number one, they had dysbiosis to begin with, they had much more adverse pathogenic bacterial growth, those dysbiotic bacteria are now producing these endotoxins. Those endotoxins are now getting into the bloodstream because the person has leaky gut, their tight junctions have opened up. Once that LPS gets into the system, one of the most common areas where people will have some issues will be their brain. So lipopolysaccharides can cross the blood-brain barrier and then activate cells in the brain called microglia. And when microglial cells get activated, that creates brain inflammation. So there's been a large amount of research now published showing that endotoxemia will do several things to the brain. One of the major ones right now is several publications that shows that it causes major depressive disorder. So many people that end up with leaky gut and have endotoxemia, not just leaky gut, but leaky gut with endotoxemia, may suffer from chronic unresponsive depression. So major depressive disorders unresponsive to any antidepressants has been identified as potentially being related to endotoxemia. Several papers on this now. So in one of these studies, they actually treated these people for leaky gut, and for a large percentage of the population, a statistically significant percentage of the study population, they actually found that for the first time, their major depressive disorder went away. So we know that inflammation can cause, inflammation in the brain can cause major depression. And most of the research in the past decade has really shifted away from trying to find a neurotransmitter imbalance as a cause of major depression to just general inflammation in the brain causing major depression. So we know that some of the expressions of endotoxemia is major depressive disorder. We also know that there's been some publications that have now investigated that further, since brain inflammation is linked to Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, other cognitive declines. They have now published many studies linking endotoxemia to mechanisms that promote conditions like dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So we know that this endotoxemia is much, much more serious than just leaky gut. And when you see those LPS levels high in the blood, that it's a whole different scenario. And this may be a reason why some people have major depressive disorder. And this is also why some people that have had chronic depression for their whole life start working with a functional medicine practitioner, and they start to change their diet and start to improve their gut health. And all of a sudden, their depression starts to dramatically change. So that's one of the main mechanisms of endotoxemia. Another main mechanism of endotoxemia is its connection with blood sugar control. And there's a lot of research now in the world of diabetes where they're finding that when there is endotoxemia, when lipopolysaccharides get into the bloodstream, they have been found to disrupt insulin receptor signaling. So insulin receptors are important for us because they help transport glucose into our cells so we can produce energy. So every time we eat protein, fats, or carbs, it eventually gets converted to glucose, and we've got to carry that glucose into our cells. So what they have found in many studies now is that endotoxemia leads these lipopolysaccharides that disrupt and alter insulin receptor signaling, thereby promoting further insulin resistance and even promotion of diabetes. So they know that when diabetics have endotoxemia, it's much harder to control their medication and their insulin intake. They know that when patients that don't have diabetes start to have endotoxemia, they start to lean towards insulin resistance. They start to have their insulin signaling pathways inefficient. So that'll cause them to gain weight easily. That'll cause them to get fatigue. That'll cause them to really crash after they eat meals, especially large carbohydrate meals. And this is because of one of the variables of this is because of the endotoxemia. Now, obviously, this is one variable. Now, if you have like a person who already overeats and already doesn't exercise and then get endotoxemia, it's going to really make it more expressed than someone who just, doesn't have those factors. But for the same point, you could have someone who's always exercised, who's always ate well, and all of a sudden they're starting to get insulin resistance issues. Part of that may be because of factors not really just their diet, but because of endotoxemia. The other key thing that happens with endotoxemia, which is especially concerning, is for those people that already have an autoimmune disease. So lipopolysaccharides, once they get into the bloodstream and turn on those toll-like receptors, are going to amplify any pre-existing autoimmune disease. So if they have celiac disease, it's going to get worse. If they have Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, it's going to get worse. If they have multiple sclerosis, it has the potential to make it worse. So we know that the activation of toll-like receptors that turns on NF-kappa B is going to turn on autoimmunity. The other thing that we know is that studies have shown that endotoxemia is directly linked to obesity, and not just from the insulin signaling pathway disruption, but lipopolysaccharides will actually activate fat cells. Fat cells are called adipocytes, and lipopolysaccharides bind to receptors on fat cells, adipocytes, and these adipocytes then create inflammation, and they also start to enlarge and swell. So there's been some direct findings that inflammation promoted by endotoxemia can increase inflammation and slow down fat breakdown and enhance fat enlargement, fat swelling. So we have issues with LPS on body composition. We also know that these lipopolysaccharide compounds from endotoxemia get into the liver, and they activate immune cells in the liver called Kupffer cells, and that creates an inflammatory reaction in the liver, upregulates the immune response in the liver, so the person becomes much more reactive to various chemicals and compounds that the liver has to metabolize and different immune triggers that way. So as you can see, there's a whole host of various mechanisms that have all been published now in the peer-reviewed literature that are involved with this LPS endotoxemia. Now, there is a list of conditions that have now been directly linked to LPS, or not actually directly linked, have a variant of their pathophysiology promoted by this endotoxemia. Chronic disease at this point, atherosclerosis, liver inflammation, fatty liver development, type 2 diabetes, obesity, kidney infection has been shown to be made much made worse. All infections can be triggered and made much worse with endotoxemia, including respiratory infections, links to allergy and asthma in the literature, some links now in studies with prostate cancer. So we know that it really does perpetuate and can be a variable in adding fire, adding fuel to the fire of any chronic inflammatory disease. So the purpose of this talk today was to kind of share with you, like, not all leaky gut's the same. You can have many different patients with leaky gut, and some will have food sensitivities because they can't maldigest, and the leaky gut in combination with undigested particles will cause food sensitivities. Some patients with leaky gut will have significant inflammation throughout their body and have their autoimmunity made dramatically worse, or have a chronic inflammatory condition triggered by it, or have massive major depression caused by their leaky gut. And the key variable that's been found to be a factor there is whether they have dysbiosis promoting LPS. And again, those can be measured in the blood. So that's the whole endotoxemia response. So then, you know, that's there. And then the question is, well, like, how do you fix it? What do you do? And this is there's a personalized approach to it. There's lots of different factors. First question you have to clinically ask is, why do you have leaky gut? And the second question is, why do you have dysbiosis? So there are people that eat a healthy diet and they still have dysbiosis because there's other mechanisms impacting their gut. So for example, you could have a healthy diet, but you could be hypothyroid, and hypothyroidism has an impact on the gut microflora, and you may not even know you're hypothyroid, and that may make you more prone to having dysbiosis, even though your diet is somewhat healthy. Thyroid hormones also are responsible for preserving your tight junctions. You need thyroid hormones to create an anabolic state so your gut regenerates and heals. So if someone's hypothyroid, they may have dysbiosis, the meaning of endotoxemia, as part of it, especially if their diet's bad. So, this is also part of the reason why we have to create a gut health program, which, like I told you earlier, Gut Health Solving the Puzzle, that we're going to be launching in January. We're going to teach you all the steps, all the different mechanisms of leaky gut, and show you how to find it, so then you can factor those out. But the most common cause of leaky gut is just an inflammatory diet. Okay. Now, the second part of it is, so one part of managing endotoxemia is you got to find out why you have leaky gut. The second part of it is you got to figure out why you have dysbiosis. Now, the most common cause of having dysbiosis is a bad diet, but it doesn't always have to be a bad diet. You could have dysbiosis because you have a gallbladder issue and you're not releasing bile salts. And if you don't release bile salts, you have altered gut metabolism taking place. Bile salts activate what are called FXR receptors that help modulate and balance out your microbiome. So those are the factors there. Now, let me tell you what's not going to fix leaky gut endotoxemia. Taking a probiotic and taking some glutamine to fix leaky gut is not going to fix leaky gut endotoxemia. And the reason I'm saying this is because this is the stuff that's all over the internet. The simple solution for conditions that are not simple. When you read what's out there, it's like, oh, leaky gut is linked to all these health problems, and this is the protocol you take. You take all these five supplements all together, and magic is supposed to happen. That is not real. That's not how these things work. So when you look at, for example, someone who's got autoimmunity or has a chronic inflammatory condition, there's going to be some investigative work that needs to take place to figure out why they have leaky gut, and then second, why they have dysbiosis, and then you would measure that. And then at some point, once you try to identify those, then you can actually then use things like probiotics and glutamine and other nutraceuticals to help heal the gut. But if those underlying mechanisms are not treated, a probiotic by itself or taking nutraceuticals support the gut is not going to work. This is why a lot of people are so frustrated when they try all these things in the internet, because they don't understand the concepts. So I was able to give you some insight into what endotoxemia is, why some people react differently with leaky gut versus other people. And I think we got a bunch of questions. And thank you all for joining us. We see people from all over the world. It's really amazing. And I have my wonderful wife, Dr. Andrew Ray, is here. Help me.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, so really quickly, you said a lot of things that are people didn't understand all the way because they're like, newer concepts or words that sound similar to other words.
Yeah.
Can you quickly say the test you use to test for endotoxemia?
Sure.
Yeah.
So, by the way, lots of labs can measure just what are called lipopolysaccharides, gram-negative lipopolysaccharides. And gram-negative lipopolysaccharides are high on a blood test, that means you have endotoxemia. Now, the lab test that I use, the one I recommend when I teach course to practitioners, is the one through Cyrex Laboratories, and I have a relationship working with Cyrex as an advisor. But they have a really great panel that measures leaky gut markers, Acudin, Zonulin, and Actomycin, which are proteins for the gut barrier. And if those are elevated, it means that their gut barrier is breaking down. And they also measure lipopolysaccharides, because you have to see the big picture. So just seeing it's on his leaky gut is not enough. So I can tell you, like, if I look at a report and I see markers for leaky gut show up and they don't have endotoxemia, I'm not as worried about it. If I see that they have leaky gut markers, like occludin, zonulin, antibodies elevated, and they have LPS levels elevated, it becomes an immediate clinical priority, because that is going to add fuel to the fire everywhere that they already have an existing issue. So it's going to be much, much different. And this is where you would really jump on top of that and try to figure out why they have leaky gut, why they have dysbiosis. It becomes much, much more critical. Versus someone who doesn't have, someone could have leaky gut and they have no real food sensitivities and no real inflammation from it. They don't have endotoxemia, and their leaky gut is not as big of a clinical concern, because maybe it's secondary to something else that's being overlooked. So treating their gut for leaky gut would be a waste of time at that point.
Okay, perfect. So the question is endotoxemia a cause for irritable bowel syndrome, eczema, that kind of stuff, skin conditions,
psoriasis?
Mm-hmm.
So endotoxemia, we didn't talk about this, but lipopolysaccharides also turn on the dendritic cells on epidermis tissue, which then can lead to any kind of inflammatory skin condition. For some people, if they have predisposition to psoriasis, it'll flare up their psoriasis. For the most common thing is people will get like eczema. Some gene types get more rosacea pattern, but it does cause it does promote an inflammatory skin condition. So that's for sure there. Now, lipopolysaccharides that then turn on an inflammatory response. First of all, if you have an inflammatory bowel disease, you're at more risk for having leaky gut. And if you have an inflammatory bowel disease with dysbiosis, you have a greater risk for having endotoxemia. So that's that connection there. But the endotoxemia may add fuel to the fire of an inflammatory bowel disease, but the inflammatory bowel disease is its own unique condition itself that may or may not lead to leaky gut or endotoxemia. So I think I answered that.
Yeah, people are just asking again. So
sure.
Okay. So then Gabushka is asking, then how do you heal from endotoxemia?
How do you heal from endotoxemia?
Yeah.
You figure out what's causing leaky gut, which, you know, we have to, it's beyond what I, it's its own conversation. Very simple thing you can do is make sure your diet's healthy, but sometimes diets are healthy and you got to dig deeper. And the second part of it, again, is why do they have dysbiosis? So leaky gut and dysbiosis are two independent mechanisms that cause them, but they have overlap. So that's how you have to then go after it. Now, for a lot of people, listen, just like getting off inflammatory foods, getting off processed foods, eating a healthy diet, getting some physical movement and exercise actually has a major impact on the microbiome, making sure they have any underlying metabolic or chronic conditions, getting rid of foods that they react to that are sensitive to, we'll fix many of these leaky gut endotoxemia patterns. But for some people, it's much more complicated. And this is why you need a step-by-step approach. So, and what I've realized over the years, and what's kind of focusing our direction in the next few years, is that not everyone can find a good healthcare professional. And just because that they do nutrition doesn't mean they're good at it. Just because they do functional medicine doesn't mean they're good at it. So we're at the point where we have to teach concepts and the thought process to the public. And the first place we're starting with this early next year is our gut program, Gut Health Solving the Puzzle. So if you go to Dr. K News, you can sign up to get information about it, and it'll launch early next year. But in that course, I can give you more, because I can have hours and hours of time to give you step-by-step approach and give you questionnaires. It's just impossible to do in a Facebook live setting. But at least you understand some of the key concepts.
Yeah, that's really good. People just get frustrated.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so Vanessa's asking, how big a role can bone broth play in helping to heal our gut? And can a small amount of L-glutamine daily help heal a gut?
Yes. So listen, bone broth is great. Bone broth has lots of healthy glutamine and factors that really help the gut intestines heal. And we're at the point where everyone that's out there has to make some effort to improve their gut health. Okay. So everyone has to really put some effort into improving their gut health. So if you're drinking a bone broth every day or taking a glutamine, that's great. But if you have something that's causing dysbiosis, if you still eat fast food and then have some bone broth, that's okay. But it's not going to, if you're in intestinal permeability and toxemia, it's not going to turn that around. It may have some degree of benefit that's small. If you remove the causes of the leaky gut and remove the cause of the dysbiosis, you can really heal the gut really quickly with things like bone broth and the toxemia, with bone broth and things like glutamine. And this is also why people are so frustrated. They go on forums and go, some person will say, oh, I did this bone broth diet for 2 weeks and did this. I feel great. I feel like I'm a new person. Because they're at the point where all they really need to do was heal their lining. Versus someone who still has underlying mechanisms causing their tight junction breakdown and still has endotoxemia, and they do the bone broth and have no effect. And they're like, I don't understand. What did you do different? And, people immediately blame the bone broth or the supplement, but they neglect to look at what is the underlying mechanism that's causing them to have it. And that's the key issue. So those things are great, but they're going to have different effects with people. And if you're at the point where it's just helping you heal, then it's a good idea. And if you have a mechanism, you still can't figure out why you have leaky gut and you have ongoing issues with it, it's always a good idea to continue to take things like bone broth and L-glutamine to be supportive. But you just have to know that it's not going to be the only exclusive treatment that's going to make it's not going to resolve the issue by itself.
Okay. Lauren is asking, where does detox fit into healing endotoxemia?
Well, it's, detox, and by detox, I mean, I'm making reference to, I'm assuming you're making reference to the liver's job of getting rid of chemicals, which is done through a phase 1, phase 2 pathway. So detoxification, as most people look at it, is looking at how environmental chemicals have to be cleared out of our body before they lead to their own inflammatory responses, oxidative stress responses, toxicological adverse effects. And that's great. Endotoxemia is different. The toxin is not happening from the entire external environment. It's happening from the internal environment. That the person's diet and lifestyle has promoted a growth of unhealthy bacteria, which is now producing their own toxins. And then those toxins, these lipopolysaccharides, they don't really depend upon phase 1, phase 2 liver for clearance. They're lipopolysaccharides. Lipopolysaccharides break down very quickly. So once they have their effect, they break down. And they don't last that long. So your liver's ability to have phase 1, phase 2 is not going to make much of a difference on lipopolysaccharides. The key thing isn't how they clear out. The key thing is that they need to stop being produced. So detox seems to be not the key factor with this, because lipopolysaccharides are not dependent upon liver phase 1, phase 2 pathways. They get produced, they bind to receptors, and they break apart, and then you get rid of them. So it's this ongoing production that's really more of the issue with it. So I hope I answered that question.
Okay. Hasa's asking, can't L-glutamine, backfire in the presence of a dysbiosis?
There's some people who can't tolerate different supplements, but it's not necessarily backfiring, and there's all this, I don't know what they call it, internet conspiracy, that L-glutamine converts to glutamate and glutamate is toxic, and some people have that. That's ridiculous. That's not how the body works. The conversion of L-glutamine and glutamate doesn't happen just because you take it. That's crazy talk. There's a lot of nutrition crazy talk out in the internet. But it's mellow out. Sometimes I get upset about it too much. The reality is that some people just can't take various supplements, and we don't know why. And some people can't tolerate L-glutamine from one manufacturer, and they can from another. Maybe how it's processed. Maybe other substances in the product that we're using in the plant that are now contaminating the product. We don't know. But for most people, L-glutamine by itself is usually very tolerable, and bone broth is also another excellent way to get yourself some natural forms of L-glutamine and healing growth factors if you can't take the supplement.
People are saying, we love conspiracy.
Let's do a talk just on conspiracy.
No! Ay, ay, ay. Okay, let's see. Is candida found on a blood test? Is Is Candida found in a blood test an endotoxin?
Yeah, so Candida, you know, that's another mechanism that falls along the same mechanism. Instead of having gram-negative bacteria that releases lipopolysaccharides, some people can have an unhealthy gut and really promote greater growth of Candida species. Now remember, Candida is part of normal gut, but if you can have too much of it, and Candida in the gut itself doesn't, you know, it's not the best thing, but it's not as bad as if someone has leaky gut. So you can measure, for example, do a bacteriology stool test with a patient and get a measurement of a mycology assessment to see if they have what levels of Candida they have in their stool sample compared to another. And some people will have these, you know, overgrowth syndromes of yeast, which are a problem. But it's much, much worse if they have Candida overgrowth syndromes and now it's in their circulation. And the way you measure that is you just measure Candida, like Candida albicans antibody in a blood test. And if they have Candida albicans in a blood test, that is much, much more serious and significant. So that's another great example of how some people with leaky gut have symptoms and some people don't. Some people that have yeast overgrowth or Candida syndromes may have very mild symptoms. Some can have severe symptoms. And one of the variables of that is that some of them have breakdown of the tight junctions, and then their Candida species get into their systemic circulation, and then those could be measured on a blood test. And that's a whole different scenario. So those patients, you definitely want to get them off sugar and stop all sugar for a while and really change their yeast overgrowth pattern.
Yeah. Okay, Tanya's asking, what about GI MAP test and zonulin? Is that enough for figuring out root causes like arthritis?
So zonulin marker, there's a study that we published in the World Journal of Gastroenterology 2 years ago, where we looked at serum zonulin and stool zonulin. The problem with them is they're not as sensitive, they're not as reliable as the zonulin antibody itself, because the high level of fluctuation. If you go to if you go to National Library of Medicine, PubMed.gov, if you type in my name, you'll see a paper come up with Dr. Vijdani, where we measured zonulin levels and compared to the zonulin antibodies, and zonulin levels go all over the place. So you're gonna miss a lot of leaky gut just with a zonulin test. However, if you do see zonulin high, it indicates like leaky gut. I really think the best test is a zonulin antibody. It's much, much more stable, much more reliable than actual stool zonulin. That would be the way to go. But if you do see a stool zonulin test, or whatever lab is doing it, or serum zonulin, and it is elevated, it means they have leaky gut. But you're going to miss a lot of them because those levels do fluctuate all over the place with leaky gut patterns.
Okay, people say, in their experience and their practice treating SIBO, many of their clients cannot tolerate bone broth, glutamine supplements, not anecdotal, just not her research. It's anecdotal, just not their research clinical study.
Yeah, and that's real practice. There's going to be lots of once the gut gets inflamed, once grouper cells get activated, once dendritic cells get super activated, once someone loses their tolerance, anything can trigger a response. And there's nothing but trial and error at that point to deal with it. So yeah, there's absolutely some people who cannot handle bone broth, but it's usually more tolerable than glutamine for those people, but some of them still can't handle it. And it is difficult. And this is the concept of immune tolerance. I think we need to talk on that.
Yeah.
We have an online program that talks about how to improve your immune tolerance. But there are some people that their immune tolerance gets so vicious and so active, they can't even take nutraceuticals to change it. And then their diet is always inflamed and active. There's a point where it gets so bad, there's very little you can really do with dietary lifestyle, to be honest. But that's real life. There are some people who will not be able to tolerate anything.
Okay, last glutamine question. Because there's a bunch.
I pushed a button.
You hit a button hard. Isn't L-glutamine excitatory?
No, L-glutamine is not excitatory. Glutamate is excitatory.
Say them again slowly.
Glutamine, GLUTAMINE, mm-hmm. is not
there you go.
Excitatory. Glutamate, GLUTAMATE, is excitatory.
What do you take? What's the difference?
Glutamine does not immediately convert to glutamate. If you look at a biochemistry chart, you're going to see glutamine, you're going to see an arrow that says glutamate. And when people don't understand how these things work, they'll just say, oh my God, your glutamine's all converted to glutamate and now you're exotoxic and this way. No, that's not how this works. There's very tight regulation systems and pathways to convert glutamine to glutamate. It doesn't just happen because you take a supplement with glutamine and it's not excitatory.
Okay, perfect. Can root canals cause endotoxemia?
Well, hold on one sec.
Oh, sorry.
I also want to point out, now, there are some people who can't tolerate glutamine because of immune reactions and loss of tolerance. That doesn't mean that they reacted because it was toxic. I mean, it was excitatory. Okay, sorry.
Okay, that's okay. Can root canals cause endotoxemia?
Yes. I don't say root canals can. So root canals can produce gram-negative bacteria. And if there is a barrier compromised, so there's also the oral barrier. There's the nasopharynx barrier. There's a lung barrier. There's a gut barrier. So if there is a permeability of the oral barrier and there is, let's say, some kind of sepsis or some kind of bacterial growth in a root canal, in a bad root canal, then, yeah, you can have endotoxemia caused by that for sure.
Harrison, how are LPS markers measured? Which labs?
So lipopolysaccharide measures for endotoxemia have to measure in blood. So endotoxemia, now you can measure lipopolysaccharides in stool, but doesn't mean that it's in the blood. So in order for it to be endotoxemia, emia means blood, endotoxin, meaning the endotoxin is now in the blood, the only way to measure it is through a blood test. So you can measure lipopolysaccharides in the stool test, but doesn't mean you have endotoxemia. So you have to have a blood test to be able to see that the endotoxins are actually in the blood. So it would be a routine blood. It would be a routine blood test.
From anywhere.
Any lab that does it.
Yeah.
I use Cyrex.
Okay. Leah's asking, can fasting help reduce endotoxemia?
Yes. So fasting can have several effects on this endotoxemia pathway. So one of the effects of fasting is you're going to change your gut bacteria. And fasting has a major impact on dysbiosis. So you can change the populations of bad bacteria just by simply fasting. So people that do intermittent fasting or people that do one-day fasting or alternate-day fasting will have much healthier microbiomes than people who don't. And then also, when you get into intermittent fasting, and once you get into the point where after 14 hours of intermittent fasting, you're going to turn on different types of gene expressions that help regeneration and growth. So that theoretically will help heal things like leaky gut. So intermittent fasting is definitely a great strategy to add in if you suspect you have endotoxemia in combination with getting rid of foods you're sensitive to and a healthy diet and whether you're taking L-glutamine or bone broth or whatever a person can tolerate.
Okay, Evelyn, will parasites also trigger endotoxemia?
Yes. So infections like parasites that can change the environment of the microbiome can promote dysbiosis. And then some parasitic infections, not all, some parasitic infections can actually cause significant inflammation and break down the tight junctions of the gut. But also what they're finding in the autoimmune disease world is something that is completely mind-blowing. They're finding that certain parasitic infections actually promote growth of bacteria that produce polysaccharides that are actually anti-inflammatory, and they help calm down inflammation in the gut. And there's some research in autoimmune diseases where they find areas of the world with the highest degrees of parasites have the lowest degrees of autoimmunity. And then they've actually then looked at certain some parasite species are actually releasing a glycoprotein, and this glycoprotein turns off the expression of autoimmunity on immune cells. They've then done some clinical trials where they've stabilized this glycoprotein, and they've found in animal studies that it's reversing some expression of autoimmunity. So there may be a drug coming out using glycoproteins, which are similar to lipopolysaccharides from bacteria, but from parasites, to actually heal autoimmunity. And I think it's going to be a major breakthrough when that happens.
Water fast or juice fast? Would you explain fasting really quick?
So fasting. Okay. Water fasting, I'm referring to intermittent fasting.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, if you do a water fast or juice fast, you're still going to get the benefits of your gut microbiome. I'm not sure about a sugar fast, especially if there's a lot of yeast overgrowth. But water fast, and I think the easiest and one of the most effective forms of fasting is just to do an intermittent fast where you have time-restricted eating, like doing an 18-hour fasting window and 6 hours of eating. You get lots of health benefits from them, but you're not totally crashing from it as well. But you can definitely do it a full-day fast with water, or if you're doing a fast, just make sure you have lots of electrolytes and sodium and salt to keep you going so you don't had those electrolyte imbalance issues.
Okay. Michelle's like, I need me some parasites.
Yeah, I know. I need some parasites.
That's really
there funny. Are people that actually do helminth therapy where they have people ingest parasites to comment on autoimmunity. It's a growing area in the autoimmunity world as well.
Yeah. Okay. Your thoughts on elevated HDL related to LPS?
Elevated HDL related to LPS?
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. HDL is activated by an enzyme called peroxidase. Peroxidase can be activated by NF-kappa-B and potentially through these toll-like receptor pathways. I haven't seen any study published on that directly, but just knowing what mechanism involved, I would say it's not. If you've seen HDL, especially above 80, you'd always suspect that there may be some activation of peroxidase from a pro-inflammatory pathway. So be aware of that. Like if you see, like the first thing you see is when you see high HDL, go, man, you must be exercising your cardio fit. They're like, no, I'm so sick, I can't exercise. My body hurts too much to even move. If you see that with high HDL, maybe it's not that their HDL is good. Maybe it's this inflammatory mechanism. And the pathways that are promoted by endotoxemia cause significant systemic inflammation, and that could definitely turn on that pathway. So theoretically, it's possible.
Okay, someone's asking about alcohol and leaky gut.
Oh yeah, alcohol. We didn't talk about alcohol, but yes, alcohol. So they actually have studied alcohol and when it causes leaky gut. So here's what they found. They found with people that had normal barriers, a drink of alcohol is not going to cause leaky gut, or even two, or even three. Or even, they found three days of binge drinking is when they would see breakdown. And that's with most people, right? So they take a healthy people that don't have leaky gut, intact barriers. If they have binge drinking for 3 days, they're going to get a leaky gut. So that's actually been a real study. Now, if you already have some compromised barrier, alcohol can break down some of your tight junctions. And alcohol is going to produce aldehydes that can have inflammatory reactions and burn up the antioxidants you have in your gut, so it can promote some breakdown.
And so, I think there's a topic for this in a couple weeks.
Yeah, we might make that a topic in a couple weeks.
Okay, sorry. Is drinking coffee difficult to process if you have leaky gut?
Is drinking coffee difficult to process if you have leaky gut? Not necessarily. No. And, okay. You know, coffee is definitely a concern for people that have high blood pressure, but coffee over the years has been shown to have lots of beneficial protective effects. The flavonoids in coffee beans have been shown to be very neuroprotective. They've been shown to really help quench inflammation. So, you know, I think like what's become really popular in recent years are people who are doing intermittent fasting and drink coffee in the morning to kind of calm down their hunger. But the combination of coffee, as long as they don't get too excited for it from the caffeine and they can handle coffee and don't have any issues with hypertension, can actually be beneficial for the gut and for dampening inflammation throughout the body.
Coffee's great. Okay. Can you do a talk on pathogens and biofilms?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
We'll put on a list.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think the next few talks you really want to kind of focus on the gut, partly because we want to promote our new gut program, the Gut Health Solving the Puzzle program. So we want to make people really aware of that. And once we launch the Gut Health program, we'll be having a live webinar specific for the topics we're teaching and throughout the program. It'll be a 4-week program. So once again, if you're interested in learning more about that, go to Dr. K News and sign up. And then for people that have signed up to get it, we'll have promotion deals and all that to support it. So we're going to be really focusing on the gut for the launch of our new course.
Okay. Evelyn, can traumatic brain injury cause leaky gut?
Yes. Traumatic brain injury is one of the mechanisms that can cause leaky gut. And there's been several studies published on that. They're all animal studies because obviously they can't induce traumatic brain injury in humans. But we do know that when they have looked at the lab markers for intestinal permeability with humans that have had trauma, they do get it. And in animal studies, they show within 3 hours that the gut barrier starts to break down. So absolutely a traumatic brain injury can cause leaky gut. And that's one of the 20 plus mechanisms of why people end up with leaky gut.
Yeah.
Now, if you have traumatic brain injury and have pre-existing dysbiosis before, like your gut wasn't healthy and had all this adverse bacterial growth, and that dysbiotic bacteria already was producing LPS, but that LPS was confined within the gut. But now the brain injury caused this LPS to get into the bloodstream, so now endotoxemia. Those endotoxins can activate the glial cells, which are the immune cells in the brain, from the injury to even get more inflamed. So you could have some people that get a brain injury and just totally fall apart, and it may not have to do just with the degree of the injury to the brain from the trauma or the force of the trauma, but it could be because of this metabolic sequelae that's taken place because of endotoxemia.
Okay, Dana's asking, can liver function markers, especially elevated ALP, indicate LPS?
No. So when you look at transaminase markers, there's no association with things like AST, SGPT, GGT, whichever marker you're looking at, with endotoxemia. So as a person who does routine blood work and does routine lots of testing with leaky gut markers and Cyrex rate 2 for endotoxemia, there's no overlap.
Okay. Jill's asking, it's a little off topic, but if I have food sensitivities, gluten, dairy, nuts, can they ever get better? Sensitivities.
If you have food sensitivities, yeah. Can they ever get better? This is actually a good question, because we're actually recording a course this week on food sensitivities, decoding the puzzle, and we explain all these concepts. The answer is yes or no. It may or may not, depending on what's the mechanism of the food sensitivity, yeah. And is it really food sensitivities or allergy? Is it immunoglobulin, IgA? Is it IgG? Is it IgM? So I would say this: if it's just a food sensitivity, then yes. If you improve your immune tolerance, then you may not be reactive to that food. If it's an IgE food allergy, the answer is no. If it's a food sensitivity to the point where you have developed a significant amount of memory cells and antibody towards it that keeps being triggered by other cross-similar proteins, then you probably will never really get rid of it. And if it's something like celiac disease where it's a genetically hyperactive response to the protein, like in celiac disease, you have a hyperresponsive T cell, you'll never get rid of it. So it's going to be an ongoing issue. So those are all the different variables. We'll probably do it. We should probably do a talk on food sensitivity too once we get ready to launch that program.
Yeah. But they're asking about carbonation. Is carbonation bad for the gut?
I'm not sure.
Sorry about that. It was from Julie. Sorry, Julie.
Oh, sorry, Julie.
Okay, Julie's in another one. She's, what's the best food allergy test? Have you heard of Zoomers?
Zoomers, yeah. Zoomers is not the best food allergy test.
Why?
In my opinion. Because they're instances, I think there's a lot of people promoting it, and they're promoting it because of various reasons. Zoomer test uses what's called microarray analysis. Microarray analysis is not very good. The standard way to look at a food sensitivity is ELISA. As a matter of fact, and you can say, you quoted me, if they're promoting microarray analysis, they have no understanding of what a gold standard is for food sensitivity. I'm 100% standing by that position. So the gold standard test is ELISA, not microarray analysis. So it's very popular because the labs that do microarray analysis have been able to jump on board with a lot of popular online forum people to really promote the Zoomer test or their profiles, whatever they're doing. But these tests are using microarray analysis and not ELISA. In the entire field of immunology, that's the test of choice. Now, let me explain something else. Antibody testing is a key part of medical diagnostics. Like, you're going to find infections, you're going to find disease from it, you're going to find all types of food sensitivities. Everything is going to be measured by antibodies. If a new technology came that was better than ELISA, it would be a complete change in the practice of medicine, in the practice of healthcare. But guess what? They're not using it. They're still using ELISA. It's the gold standard. They want the most accurate test. So I would say, no, Zoomer is not the best test. As a matter of fact, it's you don't want to, you'd rather use an ELISA testing.
Maybe someday another test will come up, but
as of now. And personally, again, I have a relationship with Cyrex. I work with them, so I have bias with them. But Cyrex does ELISA gold standard, and they also check foods that are cooked versus raw, and they also break down certain portions of foods that are very specific to different types of reactivity. And this is why you'd want to really make sure you know what you're testing.
What about Great Plains? They say it's better than ELISA.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Again, labs will make their claims. So okay. There is an established list in the field of immunology of gold standard tests. I got to tell you, it is a serious area in diagnostic medicine where they can clearly identify what has the highest amounts of specificity and sensitivity. It is not a joke. It's not marketing. It's not fun for them. This is real healthcare, real serious medicine. If a test is established a gold standard, it is a gold standard for a reason, and it's critically analyzed. If any new technology comes that's then endorsed as a new gold standard, then that should be what's used. Labs can make any claims they want, you know? And people, the other trick people use in the industry is patented. The new patented test. If you had a patent test to find antibody protein reactions more effectively, it would be a multi-billion dollar industry. Why would you limit it just to food sensitivity testing for a small group of people that do nutrition or functional medicine? This is the lab promotion marketing scam. Be aware of it. It's very real. Anyways, I think we're out of time and I'm getting off track and getting upset. Okay. But anyways, thank you all for joining us and have a great day.
You can find all of this information and more at drknews.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes, readings, and links related to this episode. You can also find Dr. Karazian's blog at drknews.com. The best thing to do is sign up for his weekly newsletter, where he will update you on the latest research and clinical strategies related to chronic and autoimmune health conditions. On social, you can find him on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest with the username Datise Karazian. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional health care services, including the giving of medical advice. And note, no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical conditions they have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. To learn more about Dr. Karazian's disclosures and the companies he advises, please visit drknews.com/about.